Welcome back to That's Kind of Wavy. We're your hosts. I'm Chaisel.
And I'm Jill.
What's up, Jill? How have you been?
I am all right. I'm chilling. I just had like a month of weddings, and they're not over yet. Actually, I have one more in like 2 weeks. And you know what? I am so glad that I have all these friends getting married right now. And I'm so thankful to the universe for having them all be on separate weekends so I could attend them all. But at the same time, like, man, that was an expensive ass month. And also, I'm tired. But you know what? It was great. It was so nice to see friends from school and people from high school. So it was great. It was great. And now I'm just here finally. I mean, it's like cold. I don't know how it is in Chicago right now.
Oh, really?
But the Buffalo weather has been shitty and I'm like scared. I'm scared that the weather is just like never going to really get warm. It was finally warm last week and now it literally says rain like 6 out of 7 days on the forecast every fucking week. And it hasn't gotten above like 80 degrees yet. Not even once. Yeah. So I'm sus.
Damn, dude. I really hope it gets warmer soon. Like here, there have definitely been some days that are cooler that make me forget that it's already June. So like it should be pretty.
Right.
Like pretty consistently warm. But we have like today's actually a really nice day. But we also had I don't know if you guys had bad air quality recently.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had really bad air quality last week because of the California wildfires happening in Canada.
Yeah. I saw that it was like especially bad in the Midwest.
Yeah.
I'm like, dude, you know, I know our country has a shit ton of wildfires too, but I'm like, I feel like our smoke doesn't just like drift into the other country and we're like bye smoke, go,
yeah, no, seriously, you
know, fuck up those people's lungs.
Yeah. And I had my windows open one of those days, I didn't realize, and then afterwards I was like, oh
yeah, no, that was me all weekend, like spending the whole day outside and I'm like, I probably shouldn't be doing that. The air quality is like over 100 right now.
Oh, lovely. But then in my mind I'm like, I mean, obviously it's better if you're inside, but I'm like, but isn't the air still coming from the outside? So it's like, aren't we fucked anyways?
Right.
But obviously, yeah. I know it's worse if it's just like full ass like raw dogging the air outside.
Fuck, we're living in Wall-E world.
Oh my
right
god
now.
For real.
Anyways, how have you been?
I don't even know what what life is right now, honestly. My brain is so all over the place. I mean, in good news, my classes are done, so that's great. I'm not done with like school fully until August, because that's when I'll get my degree, because I have to like fully work on my thesis now. But yeah, and I actually have to do some stuff after the podcast tonight too, but that is good. But also even like just the past week of not having school, although it feels so nice, it's going from having to be so strictly on top of everything, like 24/7, to I still have to be having that mentality for my thesis, but like suddenly having no structure is both like really nice and also just like chaos, because
yeah.
Oh my god, like I'm going to bed late, I'm waking up late, and then that just makes, but then I'm still exhausted even if I sleep enough, because it's like bad hours, and I'm just, and then I'm doing the thing where I wake up and go right on Instagram, which is so not good for my brain in any capacity. So yeah, but things are good. I'm trying to think. I had an amazing DJ set this past weekend. That was really fun. I got to play for the first time, like a lot of reggaeton and stuff, which I've been wanting to do.
Oh.
Yeah, so that was really fun. But yeah, besides, and I have another set this weekend, but it's out of town in Milwaukee. It's another one of those,
oh,
like Chapel Rowan.
The pink one? The pink
yes.
one?
Yes.
Oh my god.
Yeah. So that'll be cute too. And it's nice because I'll get money. But it is cute. The last time I did it, it was really cute. And it was just interesting because it's 18 plus. It was like, it also, last time when I went to it, it was really fun. But I got there and everyone was just staring at me on the stage as I was setting up, and even like during most of it, like I literally got to dancing, but at first they weren't dancing and they were just staring, and I was like, this is horrible. Like, why are you literally
so
here? Like, and I get it. I understand the tendency to face the stage even when you're dancing, but it was like, I'm not performing like I am performing, but I'm not performing like that. Like I'm not singing or something right now. And I was like, this is too much.
But like, you don't have to literally stare at me.
You don't have to stare at me. Yeah, literally.
Not doing flips over here.
Yeah, no, literally. Exactly. But that's fine. It'll be fun. But yeah, besides that, I'm like happy that it's supposed to be summer. It hasn't hit me. I hope that the weather gets better. It is nice today, but also the world is like in flames. So it's like, oh my God. Yeah. What is life right now or ever, really? But it's okay.
I feel like that's been a constant lately.
It's been literally, if it's not one thing, it's another. And just obviously, it just keeps getting worse no matter what. So it's just every time, it's just like another level of not okay that we have to not make okay because that's impossible, but that we have to somehow coexist and like continue our responsibilities despite like the complete inhumanity of everything happening in the world. But you know,
yeah.
Anyways. Yeah. It sounds very grim because it is very grim, but I'm not even like in a bad mood right now. It's just reality.
Right.
I don't know how to transition from that.
Well, I don't know. Life's pretty brutal right now.
Life is pretty brutal.
We don't have a very smooth transition for this one, but lately we've been talking about the abysmal celebrity design aesthetic that is out there, specifically looking at Kim Kardashian. No shade, no tea, but we all saw her white marble house of concrete, right? And I bet that was probably Kanye West's design mostly, but I think she still lives there. So
yeah, and I thought
we're gonna talk about it.
In a video that I saw, like talking about this aesthetic and stuff, I mean, I could be wrong because I haven't actually like watched. I mean, I've seen a lot of clips of those videos of her Architectural Digest, but I'm pretty sure that she did two, at least from this video discussed, like one like while they were together and then maybe one after, because at least this YouTuber made it seem like she had a second one after they were no longer lived together and it was still the same.
Plus, yeah, like, I think that they had like a separate Christmas one or something.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. Which I don't know what, like, if that was the one with Kanye or without, but I remember because that there was the controversy of how they got the Christmas trees and spray painted them white to match her design aesthetic.
Are you serious?
She said, we don't have evergreen in my house at all where you can even spray paint them white and have the fucking spray paint fumes wafting around.
What the fuck? I mean, at that point, why would you? I mean, of course they can't just do, well, like, if you get like a fake Christmas tree or something.
I know, they like, make white trees.
Yes, like many actually.
Like plastic like,
ones. Literally. Why did you have to? That is so crazy, but also not surprising at all for anything they do.
I know. Yes, well, today we're going to be diving into what this aesthetic is called, because it's not just celebrities. It's out there all over the world. You might have heard of the millennial grayish aesthetic theme, or the landlord special is really, I think, what it's called.
The landlord special. Literally, though.
Just white fucking walls, or, you know, when people are like, oh, we're going to modernize and, like, basically gentrify this house, and then it's like a black and gray, like sleek, like flat roof, flat like rectilinear edges type of building where it looks like it could be
it looks compound. Like a prison. Yeah, yeah. Literally. Like devoid of all life, like just literally the worst fucking vibes. I mean, in general, so ugly, but also like especially when you see it like smack dab in the middle of like actual like historic buildings or yes. something that actually have some flavor, which I don't even understand, because even those build like I mean there are some that are more colorful, which I mean I'm a fan of color, there's no issue with that, but there are buildings that you could argue would still fit within that aesthetic, but then you still for some reason have to take it that much further and just completely sanitize it of any life.
Right Yeah, it feels very like alien.
Yeah.
And that's interesting because, you know, we're going to talk about the history first of this aesthetic, which the term for this type of like concrete design with a lot of like square, straight edges that are very like, there's like a lot of like layered and like extruding pieces sometimes. It kind of like when you look at like historic buildings that are brutalist. That is the name of this aesthetic, brutalism. They look fucking crazy. Like, it's kind of giving, like, art deco, but if you literally only had, like, cubes to use. You couldn't use, like, any rounded edges.
Literally.
So, this term comes from the French. It's béton brut.
Ooh.
It's my French that I literally never speak. And it means raw concrete. So, if that gives you any idea of what this looks like, it literally is founded on just using raw materials. Brutalism is a utilitarian design aesthetic that celebrates the raw materials for used for construction and design of whatever it is that's being created. It started in the 1950s and was very popular for around 20 years, and it's kind of now making a comeback in the more like interior design aesthetic. Many brutalist designs use raw concrete. They have this real like bare bones approach to the architecture of a place. They're super like minimalist usually. And they also create this like odd or like modern, I guess, looking structures. I don't know if I would say modern. Maybe for the time in the 1950s, it was considered modern. To add some flair while still celebrating the use of like the raw design materials and having no color added. They're like, you know, we're going to add like a little like spice by putting like a jutting out.
Yeah, flavor. Like, what do you mean?
Right? And like, So the history of brutalism starts with the end of World War II. With the end of the war comes the clarity of just how much destruction has been caused all around the world, and especially in the UK and the Soviet Union. So people are displaced. A lot of government buildings no longer exist. And there's a huge need to restore order after the war. There's also a shortage of building materials at this time, thanks to the war effort where they used all of them. The Soviet Union, now a communist country, I believe. I don't really know. I don't remember much about the wars, but I think that's what happened.
I sure
right? That's
why it's called the Soviet Union. I feel like, yeah, because the Cold War was not that much later than World War II. I mean, a little bit, but also not that much later. And I feel like, I could be completely wrong, but I don't know much about when the Soviet Union started. So I don't know. Or the USSR or whatever. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that it was called that. Too,
yeah.
At some point. I don't fucking know. Anyways, we're going to say it's a communist country. It doesn't really matter at all. Except in like the values that are coming out of World War II. You know, how people are more like, well, so they're facing a lot of the same problems as the UK, where they have a lot of like overpopulation and there's an extreme lack of housing that the communist country promised would be available to all people now. So the government decides to build these tenement structures called Khrushchevka. Kovka. Here's my Russian that I also never speak. I'm so sorry to foreign people listening to this. And these tenement structures all follow these identical floor plans and use low-cost materials, aka concrete. So this is the early formation of the brutalism aesthetic, and it fits perfectly with the communist ethos. The buildings reject bourgeois pretension and reflect social equality in their sameness.
Wow, that is actually so ironic.
No, right? Right?
I did not know that that was its purpose. I mean, I can definitely 1,000% see where that comes from that type of aesthetic, because it is so bland and like lacking individuality. But it's just like insane to think of the way it's actually been used as the complete opposite of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so in the UK, meanwhile, other Western countries who reject these communist ideals, they saw brutalism as expressions of oppressive uniformity and equalized poverty. So they had pretty much the exact opposite view, even though they still like are using the same aesthetic. So they also use the cheap raw materials to create these grand buildings, but they also add more grandeur and stark concrete facades to add some more like individuality. This is where I'm like kind of like it's kind of like concrete art deco in some of these buildings.
Yeah.
So this aesthetic ends up spreading like all over, and particularly becomes apparent on very like institutional buildings. So there is the Balfron Tower and National Theatre in London that have this aesthetic, the Robarts Library in Toronto, the Perth Concert Hall in Australia. Those are all very like brutalist aesthetics and facades of the buildings. So this aesthetic was really founded on these ideals of like functionality, practicality, and cost effectiveness. And in these post-war countries, these values were extremely present on everyone's minds. And the demand for affordable and available housing created an environment where the need to build housing in institutional buildings with cheap materials and a fast time frame was super important. Brutalism is founded on this ethos of emphasizing the purpose and ethical considerations in architecture rather than conforming to the prevailing aesthetic trends. And, you know, these ties to the totalitarian regimes were hard to break, though, like the communist tie and the Soviet Union tie. Because I feel like when you think of brutalism, I kind of do picture like Soviet Union, like Russian tenement buildings. Like, I feel like I don't even like necessarily know what those look like, but I kind of like picture that in my mind.
Yeah, I agree. It is a little interesting to think of. Sorry, super quick.
Yeah.
Because actually, I mean, obviously being Cuban, like I know of Cuban history through like oral histories from my family, but I don't know much about, actually just started listening to a book on like Cuban history because I don't know much about like the general, just like more specific things that have happened throughout history. I some things that just directly impacted my family.
Yeah.
And it's crazy because I know that Cuba is known for its actually very colorful aesthetic and that, and it's like in this kind of like old timey aesthetic, which has more to do actually with the fact that like it's it's like quote unquote stuck in what was there before the revolution. So it has like kind of this like 50s and whatever came previous to that, like that type of aesthetic.
Yeah.
And it's interesting though, because they actually have had, because they turned into this, well, supposedly a communist state, like they had very close ties with the Soviet Union, but it didn't have that effect there. Like they had, there was a lot of Soviet like influence, like actually a lot of like the media and stuff they could consume certainly didn't come from the US. It was either like Cuban stuff or like stuff from like the Soviet Union, and for like communist propaganda. And it's interesting though, because I, from my understanding, I don't think that that's one way in which they influence them. And I don't know if it's from lack of like resources or what it was, because yeah, I don't think that happened. That's just like an aside point that I am wondering why that didn't also transfer over to their like other values did.
Yeah, that is interesting, especially because like they are very much known for like the colorful aesthetic and buildings there. So yeah, that's interesting. It didn't cross over. Maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah, no, for real, it is a good thing.
Yeah. So, yes, the ties to the totalitarian regimes were hard to break, especially considering how this aesthetic invokes feelings of impenetrability, coldness, and generally feels very imposing. Many movies also use the brutalism aesthetic to convey totalitarian themes, as seen in the 1984 film adaptation. And this association caused a sharp decline around the 1970s and makes sense considering the Cold War was terrifying everybody. And so now the brutalism aesthetic, aside from like how it's been adopted into this like interior design and like celebrity design aesthetic, it's also used a lot of the time in film to show like dystopian worlds.
True.
And just like, yeah, like either apocalyptic or something like 1984, where it's just like, you know, a totalitarian dystopian world, which is super interesting. And I'm like, you know, that actually makes sense. It might be why I'm picturing that type of building.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because a lot of those movies, like two movies come to mind immediately, even though there's much more that exemplify that type of aesthetic in some sort of like dystopian or like in a horror type of way. But two that come to mind are Vivarium, I think is what it's called, which has Jesse Eisenberg, and then Stepford Wives. And I know that in those, like obviously there's like this feeling of like this eerie feeling of you getting lost in like the sameness of a neighborhood that is lacking individuality in all forms. And I'm also now thinking, although I don't think those movies are directly trying to send this message, but it is interesting how like those movies are American made. And I wonder if movies like historically that were happening at the same time as this aesthetic was taking place, I wonder in the effort to be like anti-communist, if there was more of an effort to highlight, to associate that with dystopian. I'm thinking like, yeah, I see that. And I think dystopian and scary and what's happening, but it's like, have I been conditioned to think that because of the way in which that has been framed?
Right.
But regardless, it is ugly no matter what.
No. Yeah. Definitely. Like, we'll get more into like the psychology of these buildings and like why they do why they might appeal to a certain kind of person. But yeah, I feel like they do invoke like this feeling of like cold and distant and like you shouldn't go there. Like you,
right.
You know, you need to stay away. They're not very welcoming or inviting. Right. Yeah. Some general features of this aesthetic, like we've been talking about, it's usually concrete made, but they also kind of use like steel and glass. They usually have monochromatic color schemes, black, white, or gray, the grayish vibe. And there's an emphasis on bare functionality. They're usually like devoid of decoration. Sometimes they throw it in there to, you know, add the quote unquote individuality, but sure. They're very like modular and they're rectilinear edges. Like they're super square and very pointed. So outside of Hollywood, there has been a huge rise in the popularity of having gray homes in the 2010s and 2020s, termed the millennial gray house aesthetic. This consists of a home having the landlord special of white or gray bare walls, gray couches and other furniture, gray or darker rugs, and all white or gray kitchens. Very monochromatic styles that hold hardly any traces of personality or individual style. They have very like industrial kitchen type of vibe, like a literal like restaurant kitchen. And they very much employ this the brutalist aesthetic to the furniture choices, which like usually involves those sharp rectilinear edges all throughout the house. And the one article that I read was arguing that modern brutalism is trying to invoke more youthful and a rebelliousness in its design aesthetic, which I'm just like, that's funny. Like
it's how? Trying to evoke youthfulness. What a
right. I'm literally, like, what
about that? There's like, that's objectively, what about that could be everything associated with youthfulness? And honestly, I would say almost, I obviously can't speak for every culture, but almost every culture that I can think that I know of, there is color in youthfulness. Like, what do you mean?
Right?
That's crazy.
I know. I'm like, I would like to see the train of thought on that because I don't think it was explained. I just,
yeah, that's ridiculous. Yeah, like void of all life. Yeah.
Like, what the fuck? And like, and also, like, just the fact on how as you age, your hair loses color and it grays out, like that alone invokes ideas of like aging.
Exactly. So I feel like,
I don't know,
on multiple aesthetic fronts and multiple like aesthetic values that like are, I mean, especially like in Western cultures that we are most familiar with, but also outside of that, I feel like that is like, there is nothing that there's no part of me that sees something like that and thinks like, oh, this is like youthful and there are like children that are having fun in here or something.
Like, no, right?
It is literally the opposite. It's like, oh, this is like where life goes to die.
Yeah, yeah, for real. Oh my God. Okay, so the celebrity home design aesthetic specifically. Brutalism and minimalism go hand in hand, although they are different. Both can be seen in celebrity design aesthetics. Many celeb homes, especially Miss Kardashian, are designed to keep many of the everyday objects and like knick-knacky items completely out of sight. Kim Kardashian explained that her house aesthetic was meant to be intrinsically baby-proofed, and hence they wanted everything to have rounded edges. And I'm like, I'm pausing right now because I looked at these pictures and everything we've just discussed, brutalism does not have rounded edges and like soft features. Everything about it is like the opposite of baby proof. Like you could walk
into
exactly. the sink and like literally die. Like crack your head open on the fucking concrete floor. I'm just like, I don't understand.
So, but is she claiming, obviously her house does look to follow this structure, but is she claiming that she is choosing this brutalist aesthetic because of that, or is she like making it her own through the rounding of it? Does that
I
make
think
sense?
That they, I think that they like wanted to kind of like make it their own by rounding the edges. But even when they say that, like, I don't know what they mean exactly. I think that they meant like the walls, like the structure of the literal like walls, because
and that makes it childproofed.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, so they don't run into a corner on a wall. But like, if you look up photos of her bathroom,
I'm looking it up.
They have a giant square rectangle tub in the middle of the room. And it's like, you could just fucking fall and hit your head on that.
That looks so dangerous, actually. Especially because, like, a kid's height, that is so easy for them to just trip over that and, like, fall right? into. That's insane.
Yeah, I'm like, this is not baby-proofed in any way.
Whatsoever.
Her house barely even has any personalized design elements, which is why I'm like, I feel like this was mostly designed by Kanye.
That makes sense.
Yeah, because, like, I don't know. I'll talk more about celebrity style later, but I feel like they all, like, I don't know if they really have, like, personally developed style.
I mean, you know? I agree.
Yeah.
I'm looking at, and I've seen this video before, but I'm looking at these pictures again, and it's just, it's so crazy because I just would be so, like, so miserable. And I know that I love color, so I'm like on the opposite side of that, but it's, even if I didn't, I feel like this just does give like a sense of like, there is no life in here. Like, there's, what about this house makes it you? Because what about a house that is so monochromatic, and let alone a monochromatic color that is so intentionally like neutral and like removal of any, like, honestly, like, I don't know if this is gonna make sense, but it's like, there's no like opinion in this type of color. Like, it's, there's nothing, there's no statement behind, the whole point is not having a statement behind this color. And I don't understand how you can live in there and be like, this is my home, you know? Because then where's your touch? Like, where's even your stuff? I know this is for a video that's very orchestrated and stuff, but it's, I just don't, like, who does anyone live in this house? Because I don't understand.
Like, you look at these pictures and it's, I'm like, how many kids does she have? Like, 4 or 5? Right. You would never know that she even has children.
Exactly.
And it's like, they're like young. Like, yes. North is like 12 and she's the oldest.
Like, where are their toys?
So I did see, I'll talk a little bit more. They do have a toy room. That's it. They have one room and it does have like a shit ton of stuff, but like, they also have art pieces that are, they double as toys.
Of course.
That's what they have. And it's like, it's like a giant like pillow, like art structure. I don't even know. I'm like, that doesn't look like it's welcoming to hang out on, because it's also white. Like, anything related to kids, it should just not be, should not have white as the central color in your home.
Exactly.
It's going to get fucked.
Exactly. I looked up like pictures of the toy room and this random ass mini slide with what looks like a ball pit or something inside.
Yeah.
Like, what is that?
Yeah, I saw they have a whole ball pit in there. I'm
like, what even, like, first of all, if that's like, that looks like an aesthetic choice, definitely over like a functional, playful type of choice. And even then, it's like, it's not even a cute aesthetic choice. Like, what the fuck is that? That looks like you got a random like thing from IKEA that is in the middle, like, of your room and doesn't make sense.
Yeah, like, somehow the aesthetic of the toy room is like, I don't know what word I would use for this. It's giving like Sunday school, like,
yes,
play section.
Yes.
Like, it also doesn't have like fun features that you would like add into a kid's area. You know, it's just like, oh, here's like the craft section. Here's where the little toy horses are. Exactly. Here's where the dolls are.
This is crazy. I don't like it. Also, it's making me think, it's very different from this, but it makes me think of like in Stranger Things, like when, like, in like the last season when Eleven, when we see parts of Eleven's story where she's in there with like the other like super kids or whatever, it looks like this is like a place where kids are experimenting on and they just happen to have toys to engage with them. Like, this is terrifying.
That kind of is like what it's giving. Yeah. The communal room and
literally
the Stranger Things lab. Yeah, so celebrities that design their homes with this kind of aesthetic kind of get the impression that their kids don't fit into their aesthetic at all, and that they don't want to see any trace of them while walking around their house. And, literally. You know, I'm like, as someone who doesn't want kids, I get it, but also, like, you already have the kids. You should probably put something in the room that is going to appeal to them. You know?
No, literally. Like, I'm sorry, but you made the choice, so you gotta make your home kid friendly. Like, that's just how it is.
Like, they should probably feel a little bit welcomed.
Literally.
And I'm like, I feel like they're probably like, I would love to talk to Kim Kardashian's kids when they're a little bit older and kind of see like how they internalized living in a home like that, because I feel like with all the things that can influence a child and have them like internalize it to mean something about them, I feel like they probably are subconsciously picking up on the fact that like their mom has one room designated for their toys and that they don't want anything else in their house to be noticeably kid-centered. And like, I feel like that would kind of end up making me be like, well, my mom doesn't want my toys to be seen anywhere in the house, so she must not want me to be seen, and she must hate me, and she must not want us at all.
I completely agree, honestly. I mean, yeah, it's honestly not very different from, although we obviously don't actually know like the inner workings of their dynamics. Like, it's speculated for good reason that obviously all the Kardashians with their kids like have nannies that are actually raising them most of the time.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
And it's
yeah.
like, I mean, this is also like a physical manifestation of the compartmentalization that the Kardashians Oof. Use to treat their kids, and like literally just keep them in this corner or keep them in this part of my life only when it's convenient. And yeah, I can only imagine like literally not being able to in any way express like the youthfulness of also just like being messy, you know, like I yeah. doubt that that's allowed whatsoever in that house, or and there's not even shit to be messy with, honestly. Like,
right, yeah, yeah. And that's another like layer that they probably are internalizing, honestly, is like,
yeah,
you can't, you're not allowed to be messy, you're not allowed to like, because I'm too messy.
Oh my god. I fucking hate,
they're not allowed
song.
To be that, they're gonna be that as their anthem when they grow up.
Literally.
I watched Kim Kardashian's Architectural Digest home tour, and I watched three others. So I'm going to give some overview of these four celebrities' aesthetics, because they all were quite different, actually. And I enjoyed that. So the first one that I watched was Emma Chamberlain. Jesus Christ, I don't know why I couldn't say her name right now. Which, she lives in LA. Not all these people live in LA. And her house was pretty cool. I would say it's very much like, if I were a rich person, I would probably live in her house, because it was very like airy and like open. There's a lot of like tall ceilings and like open space. And she had some super cool, very like specific furniture pieces that I feel like were her like eccentric style. But most, like a lot of the house is actually just like empty white space, though. Like a lot of the walls are literally, there's no art or anything, and I'm like, I don't know if she just moved in there or what, but that was interesting to me. And a lot of her furniture is also white with like some wooden aspects, so you know, there's like a little bit of warmth in there, but there also was a lot of the strong rectilinear edges giving it like a little bit of brutalist vibes,
right?
And it was overall like a very modern, somewhat brutalist house that is full of white furniture that looks like it never gets sat on, which I feel like is true of every celebrity home. Like, it looks like you could sit there, but it would be the most uncomfortable sit of your life.
No, literally. I mean, it's like, just, it's just there for aesthetic purposes. Like, there is no actual function behind it.
Right.
And I have like, to believe, like, if you have that money, I know that there is a way to find the combination of both. Like, I know, right? Like, I don't understand what the purpose of just having this, but they also have so much empty space to fill typically that it's like they can just do that, you know?
No, right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, they're like, let's put a random piece of furniture that like,
right.
is so uncomfortable to sit on. Yeah. So, okay. Next one that I watched was Lil Baby. He lives in Atlanta.
Oh.
So his house was the definition of like modern expensive home, which I was describing earlier with that like black, like glassy, like very like flat roof. And it's got, you know, the multiple layers, and like, it's like brutalist, but using glass and like black.
I see. Okay, yeah, I definitely see there's a big difference there. But it still yeah. has that, it's still like a very, what I'd consider like generic type of like,
yes,
corporate-y, futuristic. But even then, like, because brutalist structure is typically less, I mean, it still can have like a corporate-y feel, but it is, there's something different about it. And this one does feel more like city type of modern.
Yeah, yeah. Where it's, I feel like it's like the millennial modern expensive.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. So the inside is mostly white and black, shiny floors, glass, concrete, and stone. There is barely any art on the walls. It was mostly just like large pieces and like sculptures. He had an entirely black kitchen. Like, every single surface and cabinet was black, and the floor and the walls were white. So it was very like, this house was just extremely monochrome. It looked like it would be extremely dark at nighttime. Like you would need fucking LED lights on past 7 p.m. And it doesn't feel very like homey or welcoming.
Yeah, I'm looking at the kitchen. And yeah, I guess I haven't really seen, I have seen places that like really use like black as like the main color accent, but I haven't, I don't know. It feels like there's not even like, it makes it feel like there's nothing actually even in there. You know,
right?
It feels like this like diorama of something that is not complete.
Are you like looking at the video or just
I'm pictures? Looking at like clips of the video. So I'm not okay. It's like pictures from the video on so like there Architectural was also Digest. A
part, he had two fridges directly next to each other. And it didn't I don't think he opened the second one, but the one was like mostly drinks.
I mean, yeah, I'm seeing one right now where it's drinks and then there's like what looks like it's like drinks all in like one and the other one still has more drinks on the door. And then like maybe on the middle shelf, like what I would think is like cream cheese or some type of like spread.
So like that's
and a drawer of apples.
Remember, I'm just now remembering when fuck, what was it called on MTV? When they're Cribs. Like, yes, MTV
I loved Cribs. Cribs.
And it's like I love celebrity Cribs so ones.
Much. Yes.
I feel like that's the shit I want to see. Like, open up your fucking fridge yes. and let me see what your fridge looks like.
Yes. Because
that's the true test on how much of a person you are.
Exactly. Oh my God, I forgot about Cribs. I loved Cribs oh. so much.
Right? Wow. Was that just like random people or was it always celebrities?
No, I don't think they were all like known celebrities, but they were definitely always people that were at least like rich enough. So like, I mean, yeah. back then there weren't really influencers like we know them now, but they had to have some clout to have that money. Or you know how in like Super Sweet 16, how mm-hmm. it was, it's like there were very few that were like famous people, but it was mainly just like rich people that they'd find somehow.
Yeah.
I think it was like that too. I think they had like special editions that were celebrity for Cribs.
Okay. Yeah. I'm like, I vaguely remember like some of the celebrity ones, but I'm also like, there cannot be that many celebrities that are agreeing.
Right. Oh my God, Alanis Morissette was on one. I did not realize that.
See, what a time. The 2000s. We need to bring this shit back. Because I feel like she's also a very like low-key
right.
Canadian celebrity. She's Canadian, right?
I honestly have no idea. I truly did not know that name until maybe 5 years ago. So
she is Canadian. I just verified. I gotta remember my Canadian friends across the border. Okay, yeah. So next person that I watched was Emma Roberts. And her house looked like the most regular person's house of all four of these. She was going for like a maximalist vibe in her house. It was like every fucking corner and surface had something there. And it was also very colorful. Like she had a lot of books and knickknacks. Her furniture was just like closer together. It made rooms like less wide open and more, I feel like it's more like welcoming when things are like closer together. It doesn't feel like, oh, you know, they're having like huge parties in here with
right.
like, every fucking influencer in LA. Even though I'm pretty sure she lived in California too.
You know, it is really interesting. I had never thought about it like from that specific detail. And it does feel, it's interesting how like, actually no, it makes sense in the way that quiet luxury and everything is happening now. I feel like it's similar philosophy of your richness showing in scarcity almost, because yeah, like these other houses, it is a good mm-hmm. point that it is like there's like this absence of furniture or a big separation of furniture in these spaces to maximize the amount of like open space in there versus yeah, like somehow like this idea of maximalism and having these like, I don't know, just, I mean, I don't want to say clutter because I'm looking at Emma Roberts' house right now and it's not cluttered. It's just like there is actually like stuff in there versus like being completely bare. And it's very interesting, like juxtaposing type of psychology happening there to want to have this scarcity in your home.
Right. And like, I feel like, at least in Emma's case, like I feel like a lot of the like knick-knacky type stuff is like stuff that's actually like personal to her, like
right.
it has meaning for her.
Exactly.
And I feel like that's something that like in these houses that don't have that, it makes me question like how much of like a root these people are putting down in their home and like or how like settled they feel and how that like that type of mindset then extends to like the type of aesthetic and things that you have in your house.
Exactly.
Here. Okay. So she also, yeah, she has a lot of like vintage stuff too, which I think is also specifically adding to like an atmosphere that feels more personalized and just like has more of like a history to it. And she also has actual pictures of her and her family like on the walls. She even had like a little like memory board. You know how like in, I don't know if you did this in high school or not actually, or middle school, but like you had a little like cork board where you would put, oh, here's my like ticket. Here's my bracelet that I got from like going to the bar that one time, or like this concert. She has like stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah. Like it's like junk journal, but you know, it was like on a board.
Right.
And she also had, she specifically had a bunch of dolls that she collects, like scary.
Oh,
like I don't know if they're meant to be haunted dolls, but they definitely look like
but they likely are.
Like, I feel like they can't not be haunted dolls, you know?
I need to look up her chart. Oh, she's, I didn't, because I'm curious with that choice. She's an Aquarius. I didn't realize. Like, Aquarius, Capricorn, Moon. Interesting. Hmm. Oh my God, that's the opposite of Ingrid. She's Capricorn, Sun, Aquarius, Moon. Wow.
Wow. Interesting. Yes, she had very like individual pieces, and it was more like mismatched than a cohesive put together theme, but I think that it all still like goes together really well, and it definitely like made her house look eclectic and personal.
Right.
So I felt like, you know what, Emma is a real person, I've decided.
Yeah, I'm honestly shocked. I actually don't even know she had an Architectural Digest video, and I certainly hadn't seen like any pictures of it or anything, and I'm shocked because even though I've only seen so many over the years, they don't all follow this like brutalist aesthetic that we're discussing, but they are typically closer to that, I would say. I'm like honestly really shocked I have not seen a house look like this on there ever, I don't think.
Right, that's what I was like, hers looks the most like a regular person. Like, it honestly looks like if you go into like your old grandma's house.
Yes, exactly. Which I mean, respect.
Yeah, and it makes sense knowing that she's a Nepo baby. She's the only Nepo baby house that I looked at too. So that's interesting to think about how like I don't know if things, because I also watch these all on mute so I could type at the same time. So I don't know if she had like family heirlooms in there, but it would make sense to me if she's having these more like vintage and like personal pieces that it makes sense that, you know, they're coming from a historically wealthy family.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah. Versus also, yeah, that is also I feel like, which I don't know how it would be now with other houses like this, but I feel like that there could be an argument there too for like, although I don't think old money typically looks like this, but I feel like that is closer to old money than like what is considered new money now. And I feel like a lot of people who are new money do look more like the other architectures that we're discussing, or the other aesthetics that we're discussing, like brutal aesthetics and the Kardashian family in particular.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a good point. This old money versus new money look. Okay. So it's going back to Kim Kardashian's house. We've already talked mostly about it. So you have the general picture that it's all white. It's literally made of like concrete in the entire thing. It looks like concrete and glass. There's barely any furniture out in like hallways or large spaces. It's another house where like it looks like you would use it to just party in. Like, it doesn't look like you have like family events in there, even though that's like her whole life. But even outside around their pool and like in the outdoor area, there was barely any chairs or places to sit or like put a drink down or anything. They didn't have any toys out there. Yeah, so they have the one toy room. They had a ball pit in there, riding horses, dolls. They have a whole like craft closet, costume closet. But even the overall aesthetic of that room is white. It kind of looks like your parents' basement that they remodeled to be a kid's playroom. And it doesn't even feel like the kids are really like allowed to play in there. Like, I feel like if I were a child living in that house, of course I would play there because it's my only option, but I would like not be enjoying it, you know?
Of course. It's also so crazy because I don't like, if you have, I mean, I'm sure, obviously I'm sure those kids have access to like everything, but if you have all of this money, how can you not at the very least give your kids like the type of home that they would want, you know? Like, it's just,
yeah,
that's, and I refuse to believe that it is humanly possible for a kid to desire a home like this. Like, that's just like not possible.
No, and I'm also
wondering, like, I know this is like supposed to, I mean, this is her home, but I'm also like, is this, given that they have like this facade for literally everything, I'm like, is this even like the home that they actually live in, or is the home that they designed to be able to show off? Because there is no, and again, they could obviously, like, this is a performance to even have this Architectural Digest thing happening. So they could make their home look a particular way for that and just like remove any sign of life. But at the same time, like, it, even if, like, I just doubt they actually have like art on the walls or pictures of their family or any sort of like anything in that home that like represents any sort of character. And I can't possibly understand, like, no matter how they are, there is still what I would like to think this like need for like a home that feels homey. And that's just like not it whatsoever. Like, there's not even an element of that there. Do you guys actually sleep there? Like, I don't get it.
Right. That's also what I think about, because I know they have multiple homes for sure.
Right.
So like, I don't know if they've done videos at the, like, Kim's specifically's other homes. They've done other like Kardashians' homes for the Architectural Digest, but I don't know if they've shown like her Malibu home or whatever,
right,
to see the difference there. But yeah, I mean, it definitely does not feel like there's literally any personal elements, like, right, especially not having like pictures or like mementos at all of, like, especially Kim Kardashian's. Like, you've done a million amazing things that like any normal person would probably be so excited to do one of, exactly, and you don't have any like anything to remember those by.
Literally, it doesn't make any sense. I looked up an article to see what like her home, if there is like some sign of what her home looks like now. Yeah. It's unclear from this article that I found, but I think that it says Kim Kardashian's $60 million home is pictured undergoing major renovations to add a new wing amid rumors of a new romance. So I don't really know, but it's only saying that's adding a new wing, whatever that means.
It's just going to be all weird.
Yeah, right. So I guess
it would be like easy to add onto with those materials, like, to make it look like it isn't an addition, like it was there the whole time, you know, if it's just like concrete.
Right.
So I guess that's a perk, I don't know, in a way. And also, though, so they did show North's bedroom, and her bedroom was all pink. Like, literally every single item was pretty much the same shade of pink. Her bed, her pillows, the paint on the walls, the mirrors, the lamps, every single item was pink.
I'm looking at it right now, and that's like, which, I mean, no shade if that's actually what she likes, but even that still feels like a very controlled type of, like, it still needs to fit within the aesthetic somehow, even though it's obviously very different, but that's crazy. Cause yeah, it's still everything like this. It's such a fabricated image, because like, unlike a Robert's home, for example, like you said, like, it looks like there are things there that could be like heirlooms and stuff like that, but all of these things don't look like they even existed like before them. It looks like it was all created for this specific environment, which also is a sign of luxury, the fact that you could have everything like custom made for you. But yeah, there is like literally no, it does not feel like there's any history behind any of these items. It's really weird. I mean, it feels like created by AI or something, but it's like real life.
Yeah. It does feel like that. But my only thought of like, well, actually we have multiple thoughts on why this aesthetic works, especially for celebrities. But I feel like I wonder how much the thought process includes like being a TV set, of like needing
That's
a home
so true.
That doubles as a TV set and like has to have good lighting or like good angles to film from. And I feel like having this type of like concrete white aesthetic is probably good for lighting sense, but even then, I'm like, I don't know how often they're like even filming at her house. And I know, like, during COVID, because I think that's around the time when her AD video went up, is like she was taking a shit ton of her own pictures in her house and posting them on Instagram like every fucking day. And I think, I don't know if she still does, I don't follow her ass, I never have, but
same.
I think she like has in her mind that she has to have her house be like a backdrop.
Yeah, that's a really good point, honestly. I think that's 1,000% has to be a part of it, especially because, like, I mean, what made them like rise to fame in the first place, besides like Robert Kardashian or whatever, was like keeping up with the Kardashians, which obviously was supposed to have some level of like relatability and like their familial interactions and like it being filmed in their homes and like their everyday life and like lifestyles and whatever. So I can definitely see that, whether that be a, I can see it being a conscious choice, and regardless, I can definitely see some level of unconscious choice in there, because that's all they really know for most of their life now is just like the performance.
Right. Okay. Well, now we're going to get into the why, and I'm going to mention this study first, just because this is a, like, it's not a psychological theory. This is more on like material use. My phone thought I just said Siri. Girl, I did not say that. She just activated.
Of course.
Yeah, so less color in the world, question mark. This was recently, I think, like a Curtis Connor video.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think it, his thing was like, why is everything so like boring now? And this, I think that he referenced this. I don't know if he actually like said it by name, but he showed the graph from it. So the Science Museum Group collection did an analysis on photographs of objects, and they have found that over time, the presence of color has shifted. There has been a huge rise in gray and a decline in brown and yellow, and these trends likely reflect changes in materials, such as the move away from wood and towards plastic. And their analysis showed that some of the most like colorful objects in their collection, which is, this included like literally the most random stuff, like tactile, like stuff you can hold in your hand type thing. So some of the most colorful objects were stuff from the 80s and 90s, which duh. And items like Tamagotchi toys, like in the package, and 35 millimeter disposable cameras also like in the package. Like even the packaging was just like so colorful. But even like computer games and software, cigarette packages, radios, and electronic clocks. There were so many like novelty items. This was actually something that Allie mentioned when we were in Philly recently, was how we like don't make like novelty items anymore.
Yeah, for
like
real.
Like the type of like duck phones. Like I feel, there's always like crazy like phones, like landline phones.
Yeah.
I was looking at some crazy ones and I was like, I wish that we still had landlines so I could use a Bart Simpson phone.
Dude, I know. I think like, I want one of those like cute like Bratz like lit phones, but I'm like, and I will still probably get one to have as decoration, but I'm like, I want someone to call me and be like, hello, on my fucking lit phone. But I can't.
Right? You're like, that sounds so fun.
Right? Or like a fuzzy phone. I don't know.
Yeah. No, right? So this analysis concluded that everyday objects are getting a little more gray and more square specifically over time, which makes sense because they also measured stuff like the iPhone, the rise of the iPhone, that kind of like changed the landscape of these types of like everyday objects and like tech especially to being this more like black, gray, chrome, metal type vibe instead of the fun, like remember when there was like the translucent plastic era of tech stuff, which yeah, you have that computer, the Mac,
yeah,
not a MacBook, just the,
no, it is the, like Mac, the like one of like the late 90s Macs, yeah, because you could see it's like it has color, but yeah, you could see like the inside, or like that phone that I use, like just like the aux I love like technology where you can see like through the technology, and like that itself is like the art, and yeah, there's like none of that because everything just needs to look like minimalist now.
Yeah exactly. And there was also this phenomenon called McDonaldization.
Oh.
Which describes a theory that the world is moving towards an increased rationalization of society based on efficiency, calculability, predictability, and control.
And why is that called?
In other words, a McDonaldized world is where unique local characters are often sacrificed for the sake of mass production and standardization. So, like, you know how McDonald's used to have, like, all those little guys, like the they had their like Chuck E. Cheese, Chuck E. Cheese animatronic band of McDonald's characters.
Yeah,
they like got rid of those in favor of having this more like efficient and like speedy experience of being like a fast food restaurant instead of having like personality and being like a family run business or like family owned franchise. And that is like getting applied to the world at large now. It's basically describing like how capitalism pushes this drive towards efficiency over like personalization.
That is so stupid, especially for brand. Like, yeah, I'm thinking now to, I'm thinking even like Taco Bell used to have, I thought it actually, it felt like a, is it Mandela or Mandela effect? How do you
Mandela.
Say
Mandela?
Mandela. Okay. It feels like a Mandela effect. Oh yeah, because it's based on Nelson Mandela. Okay, anyways, it feels like God, my brain right now. It feels like that effect because I thought, okay, do you remember like back when like Taco Bell had the like Chihuahua? Do you know what I'm talking about? Okay, yeah, I thought that was there for a lot longer. It was actually, I think, only like 3 years, maybe max 5 years, but I think I had looked it up at 3 years. Yeah, and anyways, that makes me think of that because, yeah, like, even like other brands would have this. And yeah, and back to like the technology thing, I like really love retro technology and I really miss the creativity that came with that. Like there's even a lot of like really cool like music devices from before that. Like there's one that I saw someone have on Instagram that it's like, it can sense like physical movement or something and you can like put your hand over it without touching it and it like warps the sound. And it's like back then, like these things were creative because it is inherently creative to make these things in the first place. But like technology has been stripped complete and just all these things in general have been stripped completely of any creativity and yeah, personalization. And it's really fucking dumb for a brand like McDonald's and stuff to do that because it did cater to kids more in that way. Like a lot of like marketing that is catered to kids, even though it's like fucked up in many ways, it's actually more successful because like, as parents, you want to make your kid happy and whatever. So I don't really understand like the psychology behind them moving away from that.
I know. I don't really like, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. Of right. Like why they would choose to do that in terms of like business,
right?
But yeah, so this person Ritzer, I don't know what their first name is. they explained that the drive towards uniformity has spilled over into architecture and design, contributing to a preference for easily replicable neutral aesthetics over unique character. The proliferation of sleek glass, concrete, and steel construction reflects this shift. So, like, these bold colors and, like, ornamentation and unique design elements are likely seen as inefficiencies and are eliminated to streamline mass production. So there's an emphasis on quantitative aspects like square footage, construction timelines, and material costs over qualitative aspects like aesthetics. In other words, it's easier to estimate costs based on readily available materials by using, like, just by not using super individual and unique design features. And colorful design might be harder to quantify from a profit perspective. So unique local colors are replaced by familiar corporate aesthetics, heavy on grays, beiges, and whites. Centralized control over design and construction by corporate chains and monopolies leave less room for individual creativity and flavor. So it's kind of like corporatized also.
That made me think of, this is very specific, and I'm sure it's happened elsewhere too, but in Des Plaines, like where I grew up, there was this McDonald's that was apparently like the first franchised McDonald's, and it wasn't like functioning, but it was just like this like memorabilia. Yeah, yeah, and yeah. They got rid of that years and years ago, and to my understanding, it is still an empty lot because no one has purchased it, and it's like, why the fuck did you get rid of this? But in front, so that's ridiculous in itself, but in front of that, there's like a functioning McDonald's, and it used to have, I don't know what I'd consider like a standard McDonald's look, like where it was kind of like just like red bricks and I don't know, some type of like red roof or something. But it literally looks like a prison now. It's like, it's a completely like modular, like just square shape with like a dark gray type of like brick, and it doesn't look like real brick or anything. And then just like a white accent. Like it looks so, it is devoid of any type. Not that it was that colorful before to begin with, but it just looked like a regular establishment. And now it looks like a prison. Like it's crazy. What about that is inviting? Yeah.
Right, I feel like it does make sense to me that it's called the McDonald'sization. Like measuring or like comparing the iterations of McDonald's like since the time it started, where like in Even until like 10 years ago, there was still a couple McDonald's in Buffalo where they had the giant arches like as a part of the actual design building feature. And yeah, now like you can see, it's like when they remodel a McDonald's and it turns into the gentrified black sleek block, like block building, that's when you know that, I don't know,
that it's over. Yeah, for real.
The neighborhood is gone to shit.
Literally.
But another 10% of the population just got added to the below the poverty line.
Exactly. Literally.
Okay, so that's kind of like the theorizing on in terms of like just like less like the difference in resources, I guess, makes sense to me of how like we're moving more toward like away from wood and more towards plastic because it's cheaper. So I guess it makes sense somewhat, and like concrete is cheaper and just like less, it takes less like refining to get it to be like usable, I guess. But I feel like there's also these psychological theories as to why neutral colors versus, you know, vibrant colors are taking prevalence.
Yeah, so I'll talk a little bit about like what I found on this history of this grayish color that we see. And Jill brought up a book that is cited in a lot of these called Chromophobia by David Batchelor that just talks about like, yeah, like this fear of color that we have seen. And I think, I don't remember when that book was written, but it's not like recent or anything. So I wonder, I mean, he's still alive, but I wonder what he would think now with like how much it's like moved in that direction, especially in like celebrity culture, which then makes people want more of that aesthetic. But like most things, this fear of color is rooted in colonialism. So this like color in, for some European countries, like these like vibrant colors, like let's say like pink and vibrant oranges and stuff in fabrics were introduced to them, especially with like Indian textiles during the spice trade. At least this one article talks about that. And I'm sure through other avenues as well. But before that, and even like the textiles themselves, this is a separate point, it doesn't matter. But in this article, they talk about how someone back then talked about these, like the Spanish called these colors like associated with like the word calor, which is interesting because actually, yeah, I do think of like warm colors as pinks and reds and oranges and stuff. That's the colors he was talking about, which calor means like heat. So it's identifying color with this like visceral sensorial experience. But it was also associated with like the quote unquote exotic other as a result. And like, I mean, still now, but especially back then, like the exotic other was seen as this like, especially for indigenous populations, was seen as this like quote unquote like primitive civilization versus like the more quote unquote civilized Europeans, which was for some reason the ideal. And in this article, I talk about how the West had like an innate discomfort with color, and they associated with like primitive stuff as a result, where the default for the civilized, aka European people, was embodied by like pearly whitish buildings, which is ultimately a hallmark of like colonialism and imperialism. And something that I found really interesting, which I feel like I had heard of before, but I completely forgot about, is that, so a lot of like this idea of like Europeans seeing this lack of color and like white and beigeness in their art as this idea of like true elegant art or like classical art is because of like ancient Roman Greco statues and stuff. But actually those statues typically were polychromatic. There are some pictures they've found that have like restored I can't remember the term for it, but when they show like through technology what it actually looks like back then, it's just that when these pieces were found, like the paint had like disintegrated and stuff, because of time, because it was under rubble or whatever. But actually, a lot of these weren't that. But then during the Renaissance, they tried replicating this type of style, which then just amplified this idea of this is what these statues look like, this is what these art pieces looked like. And that's actually not at all, it looked like there was paint, they were colorful. And this person in this article that I read called "Why We Need to Start Seeing the Classical World in Color" by Sarah E. Bond said, "To many, the pristine whiteness of marble statues is the expectation and the classical ideal. but the equation of white marble with beauty is not an inherent truth of the universe. Where this standard came from and how it continues to influence white supremacist ideas today are ignored. And this other quote from this book called The History of White People that I put on my reading list after this. I feel like I've heard of that book a couple times. It's by a historian named Nell Irvin Painter. And he said, color and sculpture came to mean barbarism, for they assumed that the lofty ancient Greeks were too sophisticated to color their art, which is not the true, which is not true. And yeah, so just like almost everything, of course, this is rooted in like racist colonial ideologies.
Yeah. And one thing we were talking about before we started the podcast episode is we were discussing this term primitive, because I listened to the book Chromophobia. So I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. But they also mentioned in that book this idea of color being associated with primitiveness. And it was not like fully explained, I think, as to what his definition of that word is in this context. But so my understanding when I was listening to this is I thought, because I have this like geologic anthropological background of like knowledge, my mind immediately went to like primitive like people in terms of like Neanderthal, like our ancient ancestors, and like them discovering the like how to make dyes and things like that. So I was like, oh, okay. I mean, yeah, like I guess that isn't also great because they're like dumber than us, I guess.
Like literally, but, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, but then it makes a lot more sense that they're like racially they mean primitive in terms of like how they viewed other cultures that weren't the Western people.
That is a really interesting perspective though, because like you're like you understanding it that way is like, yeah, that like, I mean, that is what that term like technically should mean, right. Like that is literally what that is, but instead of course like it when it's actually used typically it's like derogatorily, like
yeah, not they should put that people.
Yeah, right, derogatory.
<in parentheses. laughs> Yeah. We need the tone indicator. Yeah, behind right. The word.
Yeah, that's all I had to say about that.
Oh, okay.
Because I have a lot of notes, but it's all like the same in different words. So oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'll talk about chromophobia in a second because I had some other stuff written before that. So neutral colors, I guess, can be seen as like sophisticated and practical, I guess, by some people. That's subjective. Let's just say, because I don't agree with that. They don't waver in taste and will stay stylish for all eternity, meaning you won't need to be repainting the walls in a few years to match your new taste. Of course, this is obviously subjective because I live in a home with no white walls in my entire house. So I don't agree with that. Like, yeah. I feel like if you find a good neutral, like actual color, even like a more like muted green or blue or yellow, like that, I feel like that has the same not wavering in taste and staying stylish for eternity. But okay.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And I also feel like there's some degree of like rich people truly having no idea what their own style is, especially like on an interior decor level, because like they get dressed all the time by other people. They're styled by stylists. They wear brands for ads and campaigns, and like they get gifted all these brands. So like sometimes they're not even like purchasing their own clothes or like stuff that they have. And it feels like so much of the time they spend having other people shape their style for them.
Exactly.
Of course, like with stylists, like they can have some say, I'm sure. They're, you know, they're not just like wearing literally anything. But then on the other hand, some people do just be putting on any fucking ugly ass thing.
Literally, though.
And I feel like doing that for years can lead to people becoming like lazy in terms of developing a style, or just not even like caring about developing their style, especially when they like don't really have to.
Right.
I don't know. And I also feel like celebs who focus on being models or like a walking clothes advertisement lack a sense of style in other realms, like their homes, especially in the Kardashians case. I feel like it might be an element of them, like, I don't know. I feel like they just like don't really I don't, this is also me speaking from a place where I'm like, yeah, I know I don't obviously see them 24/7, so I don't know what they're doing like every minute of every day and making every decision. But I feel like they just like don't even really like see a need to develop their style.
No, I agree. Also, it's interesting to mention specifically models, because like what like at least like the standard model is supposed to be like this like blank slate, which is, I mean, thinness is glamorized for endless reasons historically, but it's also glamorized, like it's also like quote unquote what they claim to be necessary in models, because like having like a standard thin like boxy shape makes you this like blank canvas for the way that clothes like are generically made. So
yeah,
it is really interesting to think of how like that by proxy can make them not have style, because they're not supposed to typically change their hair color, or they can't like have tattoos typically, you know, unless you're like a specific type of model, you know. So it is, yeah, it's a very interesting like observation with them specifically,
right? So I feel like there's also, I mean, I say I feel like, but that's just how I start a sentence sometimes. Yeah. there are also psychological quote unquote benefits. I don't know if that's really the word that I would use to being minimalist.
Yes.
And having like less clutter in your environment can help you, your mind feel less cluttered and stressed. And it's also like reducing consumerism.
Yeah.
Which it feels weird, like juxtaposed to celebrities, knowing how much, first of all, how much free shit they get, and also how they are literally like an ad. Like that is like their job is to perpetuate consumerism.
Right.
So it's, yeah, I'm like, huh.
But it's also so interesting to think of how like when you say that, it's like, yeah, perpetuate consumerism. And it's like, oh yeah, for people who aren't other celebrities or people, it's like, and actually there's, I was trying to find it for this and I couldn't find it. I know it's an article somewhere, but I saw it originally as a post and I couldn't find it. But like, it was just this post kind of like in like an artistic way documenting Latino households specifically, because like growing up, I remember like, especially like when I was younger, like my white friends would come over to my home and see like the clutter that we would have or something. And I could definitely feel judged in certain ways, but it's like, and it's actually a very common, and for like in people, which I, even though my family did not have like money until like later, I did live a very privileged life like later in life, but, and I never was like impoverished to a crazy extent. But when we did have less money, when it was just me and my mom before she was a doctor here in the US, like it definitely, it was looked at like almost like chuggy or whatever to see a home like that. Or even though we would repurpose things, like it's like this very specific Latino thing to have like that butter that's like in that jug that's like old country butter or whatever is very stereotypically used, like repurposed for other stuff as like a leftover container, like
leftovers, yeah,
yes, and stuff like, yeah, so, or like
just like to cookie hold tins,
yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. And that stuff is seen as this like not classy, like poor thing. Like maximalism is often associated with like, yeah, like not wealth in some ways. So it's just interesting how it's also a way in which to distinguish like the classes, and just the absolute irony of like you then seeing the impoverished people who are like, I mean, typically like repurposing things, but see it as like not that, and typically actually then argue that they aren't being green or sustainable when they are, because they're repurposing things. But also, yeah, the consumerism that you as influencers and celebrities are pushing, and that it's your job to constantly be doing, especially again, especially for influencers, like, but then you guys have none of that because you guys don't have to deal with like the clutter and like the mess and whatever else. So it's just very interesting, like just this constant like catch 22 with what it is that you're selling versus what you actually are versus what is valued, you know?
Yeah, I feel like it's all like very hypocritical.
Exactly.
Or just like they all can't like exist at the same time. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. And I'd like it is definitely a level of privilege to not have clutter.
Exactly.
You know? Because like even in my house, which I would say we were like middle class growing up, I mean, there was definitely clutter like all over like it's always like mail and like just random papers and stuff. And even I would be like, oh, my God, get this out of my fucking face. Like, it makes me feel like we need to like clean all the time because there's like, you know, shit gets on the papers and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah. So moving on to the chromophobia lore. I'm gonna try. This book was very I feel like this was like literally someone's like dissertation. It was written by David Batchelor. I feel like this was his dissertation. Like, what's that word for stream of consciousness? There you go. It was kind of like that, but like for a person who's like, I have a PhD, 100%.
I mean, like, that's literally like that is exactly a dissertation. So yeah. Yeah.
So I'm going to try to make it sound like normal. Because I also was listening to this at work and I was tuning in and out sometimes because I'm like, most of the time I don't know what you're referencing. I'm sorry, I'm not a fine arts history person. I don't know all these random artists and shit. But there were some points that were made for sure. So people have theorized that having white, gray, or black majority in your environment can aid in feeling like you have some sort of control over your environment and life. The book Chromophobia by David Batchelor was recommended in so many of the spaces that I researched for this topic, and it definitely did not disappoint in terms of like diving into the psychology of the concepts of color, which is something that I'm like, that I gotta ponder that one day a little bit more when I'm high as fuck, like about like what color, like what is color?
No, for real.
This is a side point, but there was a whole part in this book that I was like, this is something I need to think about when I'm high. That was like, you never think about how, well, actually you would probably be a good person to talk about this with. So like in the Spanish language, how many words are there for colors? Like you have like the same concepts of like the primary colors, and then you use the primary colors to make like orange and green and purple. And then there's the tertiary colors of like how you mix those up and like split them more.
So I don't know how many there are in Spanish, or like how many like subdivisions I would say there are. It's actually very interesting because for my psycholinguistics class last, like in the winter, there was a study that we read that was studying the color, like understanding if a group of Japanese participants saw blue in the way that we see blue.
Talked about that because they don't have a word for like green, or it's like, right, they don't have a word for blue or green.
Exactly. So, and it's just like, and we read that study in like, to support the idea that, I mean, everything, like emotions, everything are culturally and linguistically constructed. So like, yeah, like color, if we don't, obviously, if we can see color, we still see that, but it doesn't mean that we'd interpret it as whatever blue feels like and is embodied by us, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like that's something we've like talked about in our group chat about like color blindness.
Yeah.
In terms of like, well, then what, like, how does the spectrum of color blindness work? Like, is the blue that I see the same as like the same blue someone else sees? But then it's like to apply that to different cultures. And in this book, they described like how some cultures only have like 5 words for different colors, and how like,
that's crazy,
how that then can impact your interpretation of like the world, and like how that just like changes things. And I'm like, that was something I never even thought about, of how some cultures don't even like have words like lilac to describe a type of purple, or like, you know, it's like those types of like more made up concepts.
Yeah,
like light blue, like, you know, like sky blue
color. Yeah, like outside of like primary colors, like the subdivisions, or even especially when, yeah, like words get more technical, like when you think of like Pantone colors, as much as I love Pantone colors, like Peri-Peri, for example, you know, it's like those are very specific things that do shape the way we see the world. Because like, for example, like me being someone who like does like associate feelings with like colors and stuff like that is interesting, because then it literally shapes the way in which you can navigate even your emotional experience to have a different perception of color.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly like what this book was arguing, kind of. So, okay. So I'm like, this is already starting off with like, this is a heady. But it will make sense. It will make sense. Okay. So this also is kind of relating to the primitive idea. And like that racialized, ostracized association. So Batchelor argues that colors, like color as a concept, every color, not individuals, except don't include black, white, and gray. Color. So colors are made out to be related to two different concepts throughout history and throughout art, and even like subconsciously and consciously. He's like using all these different realms to argue these points, which I didn't really include a lot of them because most of them were like really up in the air or just references I didn't know. So they're related to two different concepts, both of which diminish and ostracize color's place in society. So one side argues that colors are related to foreign groups, the feminine, queer, Asian, primitive, vulgar, pathological, and infantile. These groups and concepts that are used to alienate and differentiate between the current sociological norm. They are considered dangerous and alien. And the other side is arguing that color is superficial, supplementary, inessential, or cosmetic. That is to say, it is secondary to experience and unworthy of serious consideration. So he backs this up with like a myriad of historical evidence, mostly related to art and how colorists, which are artists who pondered the use of color, not like racial colorists, discuss their work. So it kind of goes off the deep end in terms of like the philosophical ramblings. But it does make sense when he is putting into context and kind of like coming up with these word associations. So colors are seen as like emotional. They're seen as trivial and dangerous, psychotropic. They're related to drugs, chaotic, even like kid-like and dreamlike, even almost like a descent into mental illness because of all these different, like even like film associations that are put together with different colors. Color is seen as this imposition of artificial or an illusory layer in a monochromatic world, like makeup he was associating it with. Whereas white, though, carries these ideas of purity and virtue, being heavenly and perfection, closer to God and without flaws. The use of white is a literal whitewashing of culture. He also mentioned this law of Ripollin, which I don't know if that was an actual law or not, or if that's a person. But it says every citizen is required to replace his hangings, his damasks, his wallpapers, his stencils with a plain coat of white Ripollin. His home is made clean. There are no more dirty, dark corners. Everything is shown as it is. So I could really see like some celebs adopting this frame of mind, like some of these connections to color happening unconsciously, honestly. Like it makes sense to me that white is associated with this purity and like virtue and being closer to God. But I've never really like pondered the morality of different colors. But I think that that's like what Batchelor is arguing, is that the spectrum of white to black is considered more like moral. And the rest of the rainbow is seen as corruption.
That's really interesting because actually something that we talked about a lot. So in my anthropology classes that I've taken, sometimes like anthropology compared, like let's say psychology or sociology can like verge a little closer to humanity style of thinking and like more like philosophical thought, which in philosophy, I know that this concept of like aesthetic and moral value is discussed, which I don't know much about that type of analysis whatsoever. I just heard the term a lot in these classes because we've talked a lot about how aesthetic and moral value, emotions, everything are all culturally constructed. And it's interesting to think that because it's like, yeah, like there is morality associated with aesthetics itself. And it's also very interesting hearing all of this in an age where there is this like constant debate and just like concern with AI, because it feels like you could say that AI is that like white to black spectrum versus like if we're using this ideology versus like I would say humans are innately in this dichotomy, the color spectrum or the rainbow spectrum, because there's like the sterilization that comes with like the white to black of like the messiness of emotion is emblematic of like the messiness of like organic being versus like a machine or something, you know? And so it's like really, that's like really crazy to think about and very heady to think about in the world, the current circumstances, honestly.
Right. It made a lot of sense. Like, I feel like there is a lot of he didn't mention misogyny like by that term, but I feel like associating color with emotions is to inherently consider it to be feminine.
Exactly.
And is then to consider it misogyny.
Yeah.
That people end up like choosing to not use color or think that like associate color with like, I don't even know, infantileness. What was the word we use for that? Or just, yeah, or like messy or like just like undesirable in any way. And bitch, it doesn't make any sense to me because I subjectively would rather have color in my life than not. Like, I'm thinking of like the clothes I wear and stuff. Like, of course, white and black match with more things, but like wearing a completely monochrome outfit is just like not like my daily style.
Right. I'm like very passionate about this. As someone, like, I am like very, very passionate about color. Like, I feel like in my style and my everything, in a way that I think, because I'm someone who's so deeply emotional, and I guess like this association with like emotions as like just like the colors as this like, to me, like innately human type of experience. I mean, that's also my existence in the culture that I have been like raised in and everything, you know. Again, like, could be different, as we were discussing moments ago, with like, you know, I don't know how it would be if I had a different concept or a more limited concept of the range of colors in my life, but I do feel like it is this thing that really adds value and that I really care about and think about all the time when understanding the world around me, my style, everything. So it is like, hearing this, I'm like, no, I am an avid like pro color person. Like, this is making me angry because no. And it's also really interesting because this concept of associating white with purity and everything has obviously also been used in very racist ways. Mm-hmm. But it's like, even that concept, like, because even like biblically, white is associated with like heavenly figures and stuff like that. But it is. And I guess, like, if you think of like night and day, like, obviously the sun is like a source of like life, which is light, which is associated with whiteness, versus like the darkness. And I'm thinking about this a lot actually while watching a lot of vampire shows, because them having to live in the night and everything, like, and they're dead creatures, yeah, whatever. So it's, I'm thinking about like light and dark and stuff like that, and like the power of the sun versus night. And in this context, but it's still like, even though those things exist that might inform our decisions about it, it's still so like, people think that like white is inherently like this like signal of purity. And again, in many ways because of like religious reasons, like historically, but also that even that alone is culturally constructed, you know, because like that's still like, yeah, someone, to an extent, someone decided, or a group of people decided that that was the case and wrote stories and that framed that in that way.
Right. Yeah. It just makes me think about how everything in our society is a construct. And like, it was just made up. It was made up by someone. And if we don't like it, we don't have to fucking believe in it, even though society like pushes it on us from every direction. But yeah, I agree. I am pro color, especially like, I think about when I go out into the world and like the stores that I go into, or like the brands that I flock towards, they all are like colorful. And they're all like, I feel like color implies some type of personality and character, like we mentioned earlier. And I feel like I would rather support that than support something that feels like sterile and lifeless. And, you know, like even valuing purity and virtue, I'm like, I don't want that. I would rather have like the messy, dirty, and I don't know, like broken and non-religious
right
types of things in my life.
Yeah, it's so crazy because I'm literally like, I mean, I'm always on a quest for more color, but I like specifically like I'm on a very like I am actively trying to find ways to bring more color into my apartment, which my apartment is pretty colorful to begin with. But like, I'm getting like stick on like fake tiles and stuff that are colorful, and like I want to get wallpaper and whatever, because like to me it's like the opposite. It's like I'm like, oh, my life would be better and I would have more organization and everything if my apartment was more filled with what I love, which is hella color. So just, and that to me, mm-hmm, makes me more functional. So to think that these people, and I do understand how obviously like having less clutter and everything and like less physical clutter is better for the mind to like think and not be stressed and whatever else. But it is crazy that like so many people have this ideology of the opposite of like the removal of color will bring me more peace. It's like I could not see it more differently.
Right. Especially as a person with blue eyes. Okay. Being in a room, being in a bright, like when it's sunlight outside, when it's sunny and you're in a white room,
Oh my God.
My eyes are on fucking fire. I'm like, I can't even see. I can't even properly look around. It's just painful. So yeah, I'm like, no way. I also do not associate it with like feeling more clear-minded. If anything, I picture like a doctor's office.
Yes.
And, like, the sterile LED lights. And I feel like more confused and like scared and like a fucking deer in headlights in that, yes, kind of environment.
Yeah, like I feel like because I think asylums historically and stuff, you know, it's like a white padded room or whatever. It's like I think like the opposite. I think of like being lost in my head. I think of like dissociation. I think of just like actually this ties in with, I know I've talked about this definitely because maybe not on here, but just because it was such a pivotal moment in my life then and now. My first existential crisis was me trying to conceptualize, and I was like 5, and I was trying to understand the process, like I was trying to conceptualize what nothingness is. And this all came after that SpongeBob episode where like Squidward is traveling through time.
And I feel like that also was like traumatic moment.
Literally, it really was. I remember sitting like at my grandma's house, like in Miami, looking out the window, trying to conceptualize what nothingness would be. And I first pictured, I think, all black, but then I thought, but it's still all black is something because it is still, I mean, black is in theory the absence of color, but it's still something that I'm conceptualizing, which inherently not makes it not nothing. And then I tried to think, okay, maybe it's all white. And I'm like, no, that is like the active inclusion of light and color. So that is not nothing. And then I started crying because my brain just can't, like, could not possibly comprehend that even now, let alone when I was 5. But anyways, I forgot what I was going to say about that. That made me feel like I was going crazy. So it's like, even like the thought of like an all white room then was like, that's still, that was like to me the concept of like nothingness and just like being completely lost. And even Squidward in that episode when he was like in a room where he was like, I don't even fucking know where in time and space. It was also like, yeah, weird? Nowhere, exactly. And yeah, so that just is scary. Like you need the inclusion of color is the presence of something, you know. It's like, I don't know anything all white like that is like, get me out of here. I don't like it.
It's especially interesting to think about. I think that this was also a point that in the book David Batchelor mentioned about like as an argument against why people like would like to include color is that you don't really see like, well, no, now actually I can think of some pure white animals and like natural things that exist in the world that are pure white and pure black. But like most things are colorful, especially like birds and fish are all super colorful. So to like, I don't know, it's interesting to me that people would rather have like a purity mindset and like want less color as opposed to like sitting in our humanity, sitting in our like connection to earth by like utilizing color or like embracing color.
Right. And like besides celebrities and stuff, even just like wealthy people in general, like I think of like tech bros and stuff, and like those are the people who like are like on the grind and trying to maximize like whatever they think their brain is doing. And like they typically are associated with liking that type of aesthetic too, because or like just like a very sleek, minimal like aesthetic. And it is because, yeah, I think there's also like, I mean, there is this morality associated with like productivity because of capitalism and everything. And if these people think that that will make them more productive, then they're also somehow better than for having this like absence of color or stuff in their home.
Yeah. Yeah. They also mentioned a lot of like movies that are in black and white and then they transition into color at a different point in the movie. And like now I can't really remember the arguments, like why that was mentioned. I think a lot of the time they're talking about how like when the color comes about, it's like they're like descending into chaos or like descending into a dream, or like it's considered like a fall there's a lot of these associations with like falling from something into color.
That's really interesting. So,
yeah, they like associate it with this like loss of consciousness as to fall into color and like to lose yourself, to lose your sense of identity. And I think it like I'm just thinking like how racist a lot of this like chromophobia is, where it's like, okay, so white people were like a little bit scared of some colors.
Literally. So
like, we need to get rid of them.
Literally.
In a fucking sterile world.
Literally.
But it's interesting. I'm thinking about like Schindler's List, and I feel like that, how like there's one.
I've actually never seen it, so don't
Yeah, this isn't like an actual spoil. I don't know if you know how like it's in black and white.
Yes.
But there's only, I can't remember if it's like everything that's red or if it's just this one scene where like red is involved on like a little girl. And that's like the only color you see throughout the movie. I feel like that is like kind of corresponding to this humanity aspect of like, it might feel like humanity is all lost right now in the black and white world, but like there is some hope still by, you know, showing the color. And they also mentioned like the Wizard of Oz, obviously. Oh, yeah. That's like the main one, which matches up with this like descent into a dream. And like, you know, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the Wizard of Oz, it was all a dream, everyone. and like losing your identity and how, you know, like the Kansas world, like at the beginning is like pretty shitty. They treat her like not very nicely. Little Miss Dorothy is just running around and, you know, then she goes to Oz and she's like independent and like living her life, and she's got to go wear her ruby slippers to get home, and they're glistening and shiny and like everybody's happy. There's even a green lady. It's just, I don't know. It's very like, yeah, like dream world, like, and just like not reality. But yeah.
It's also very interesting because, yeah, like the way even without like psychedelics in the conversation, like a lot of the way that these things are being described is as if color, which obviously I know that like obviously psychedelics like do amplify color in many ways, but it's like even in these analyses that preceded, I guess, like at least like Western understanding of psychedelics for some of these things, they still see color in the way, like almost like synonymous with what the psychedelic experience is like. And it's ironic given that the psychedelic experience does amplify color. But yeah, it's just like the more I hear all of this, it's like, yeah, so color, I mean, is like very emblematic of what like real life actually is and like real human messiness actually is, versus black and white to me is not only an oversimplification and like removal of the actual human experience if we're using these like these spectrums of color to understand the human experience, I guess, in the way that we think, but also to me it's like they see that as like, see the white to black spectrum as this like freeing thing, when actually what I really see it as like is like control. Then it's like control of your emotions, like control of like, but in a way that's like not in a way that in itself feels like a fascist state. Like honestly, in a way that's like really, really weird, and not in a regulating way, but in a way that's like restoring order in a specific way.
I think that was also like a main argument of this book too, is that like I think it's kind of related also to like the Catholic patriarchy that existed. I mean, it still exists now, but like was even more prevalent in a time pre anyone in a minority group getting rights. Which is actually a majority of history, right, if you think about it. But yeah, so I think it kind of relates to like how men were terrified of, white men were terrified of women and people of color and people just different from them. And what was their way of stopping that fear was to control people. And what's one way of controlling people without outright, you know, ordering them to do something? We're gonna take out the things that make life fun and like personal.
Exactly.
And give you any sort of sense of like individual power.
Exactly. Well, thank you for listening to today's episode. You can listen to our podcast on any of your podcast listening platforms. We post on a monthly basis. You know where to find us on social media as well. That's kind of wavy. And yeah, we'll see you next time, but no, we won't. But you'll hear us next time. Okay. Bye.